Hi, thanks for joining us for this message from Red Church in Melbourne, Australia. We pray that you are blessed by it. If you'd like to know more about Red Church and its ministries, or if you'd like to support us financially, you can find out more by heading to redchurch.org.au.
We are going to begin with a reading as we come together to celebrate the resurrection, and it's from John's Gospel. And it tells the story of Jesus coming into the world. So we're going to read it now. I think we've got it. John 1, verses 1 to 5. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. At the turn of the 20th century, around the year 1900 to 1914, a series of small towns and communities sprung up in what we now know as the Dandenongs. Places like Sassafras, Upway. Some of you may live in these places. And these were small communities, somewhat disconnected from the rest of Melbourne, which was pretty connected at that time with the train line. And Melbourne actually, for a period there, I don't know if you knew this, was the second biggest city in the British Empire after London. It had gone through a boom, which then, just before this moment, had a recession as a housing bubble came about in our city, and prices were massively overinflated. Just, we don't know anything about that today, do we? It's just ancient history. But the market popped, and a number of people had to move further out. And so many people found themselves living in the Dandenong Mountains, but they were quite disconnected, connected by a train line that we now know today as Puffing Billy. But these small communities became engaged in an absolute panic in December of 1914. Something mysteriously began to happen at night, and farms and small towns all began to see something breaking through the darkness. Light. This was unusual because light does not happen in the middle of the night. And so people would go out the back of their houses, gather in town streets. And in these towns, we know Upway, Sassafras, would gather and together see this mysterious apparition. Was it ghosts? What was it? People did not know. And this took over, not just Melbourne, but it became a kind of moral panic in the whole of Australia. The Adelaide Advertiser reported that every night people would gather in the Dandenongs and not go to sleep until the lights had disappeared and they could finally relax and go to bed. It remained one of those sort of mysteries until one expert wrote into, I think it was the Argus, the competitor of the Age at the time, or I think it was Melbourne, one of Melbourne's first newspapers, and said that he actually worked out what was going on. That with his military background and his understanding of Morse code, he'd been watching the lights and had deduced that this was a signal to Australia's foreign enemies. And somewhere in the Dandenongs lay lurking amongst the ferns, foreign agents. This again caused an even bigger panic as the residents of the Dandenongs went about in search parties, seeking out these foreign agents going through the dense forests. But alas, they found nothing. But nevertheless, this continued night after night as the lights kept appearing. Finally, the War Department, Australia was engaged in the First World War at that time. The war had been going for a couple months. The world seemed in tumult, and this contributed to the panic. Sent out two gentlemen from the military who then spent some freezing nights for about three nights driving their car around the Dandenongs trying to find these foreign agents. Finally, the Argus reported that on the third night, absolutely freezing and tired, flying around in their car, they discovered what was responsible. A gentleman with a movie projector had been traveling around the Dandenongs, and this was part of his rudimentary marketing campaign for people in those towns to come and watch what was at the time a technological novelty, the moving picture. And the mystery of the lights of the Dandenongs was solved, and those who live in those areas now rest in peace. But what this tells us is we live now in a time where we understand that we have control over light and dark. We turn on lights, all different kinds of lights, battery-powered lights, electrical-powered lights, hydrogen lamps, all these different things, and we don't think about the fact that we can easily conquer dark. We have street lights. There are lights everywhere. In fact, we actually struggle to see the stars in some parts of the city because of light pollution. But this is not what it's been like for much of history. For much of history, when darkness came, it would be something that reduced our movement. In Australia, books were produced where you could see the times that the moon would be full so that you could then plan your church meetings or governmental meetings or community meetings because there would be enough light for people to walk. Light is a constant element in our lives, but this has not always been so. In the past, the dark was often all-powerful, all-encompassing. And for those of you who are here on Good Friday, we spoke about this. We spoke about the imagery that we see in the scriptures around darkness. And we spoke of the darkness that came at the crucifixion, where it says in Luke 23, verses 44 to 45, it was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining. And as we remember the death of Jesus, we spent some time, in a sense, standing in this dark that's symbolic of mourning, judgment, and death, of anti-creation, seemingly the undoing of what God had brought into the world, the death of the light of the world, Jesus who'd come into the world, everything that seemed to be the opposite of God. But now here, on Sunday, a very different day, I want to cast our attention to the final part of that verse. I'll read from the start where it says, it was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining. And then it says, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Under the cover of darkness, it seems like darkness has won, but there are things happening. We spoke about Mary getting up before it was light in the darkness. Her faith was something that was happening, a small seed of faith in the darkness. We spoke about the fact that Jesus on the cross was giving up his life, paying the price so that we would not have to, defeating sin and death. And what we read here is that something was happening in the temple. What was the temple? The temple was the continuation of a structure that God had instructed the Hebrews to build when Moses went to the top of the mountain to create a tabernacle, patterned, Hebrews says, of what is in heaven, a dwelling place for God. This tabernacle was mobile as the people moved through the wilderness to the promised land. In the promised land, it sort of moves around until it settles in Jerusalem, and there's a series of temples that are built. Some are destroyed, but finally, at this point, we had a temple that was built by Herod the Great. And in it, there was a great curtain that separated the holiest of holies where God's presence dwelt. Now, the temple was seen at this time. When we read of how it was seen by the contemporary Jews of this period, the temple was a place of light. The rabbis saw it as the place of eternal light. Where God is light. The temple was the house of light. And in the temple, as you see here, was something that looked something like this. This is you might know this is a candelabra, a lampstand, or in Jewish or Hebrew, a menorah. And this was something that was in the temple. And it had a very important symbolic meaning. It resembled a bush. Now, the modern menorah looks more like this, but what archaeologists can piece together is that the menorah in the temple actually looked like a tree. And this points back to a couple of things. It was a flaming tree. What does this point back? This points back to Moses' encounter at Mount Horeb with God in the burning bush. It even points back further to the tree of life that we read of in the beginning of the book of Genesis. During the festival of Hanukkah, the Jews would celebrate the victory of the Maccabees over the Seleucid Empire, a foreign empire that had come in and had colonized them and taken over their land. And there was a period where the lamp, which never went out, was kept miraculously burning with small amounts of oil in the temple. But the thing that pointed most to the fact that the temple was a place of light was what was known as the Shekinah. The Shekinah was a word which described the glory of God. Exodus 40, verses 34 to 35 says this, when the glory, the Shekinah of God, comes into the tabernacle, it says this, then the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Why could Moses not enter? Humans once walked in the place where the tree of life was, where the light which brought life was. But Adam and Eve rebel, wanting to be like gods, responding to the seductive whisper of the serpent. And then they're expelled from the garden, kept from going in by cherubim, and humanity always then walks in a kind of darkness, a separation. And so God coming in his Shekinah glory, like a lit up cloud, is something that humans cannot come. Moses wants to meet God face to face, but there's something separating and we can't move into the presence of God fully because we have not been cleansed. We have not been redeemed of that rebellion that we have in us to do it in our own particular way, not God's way. So sin meant that the human heart lived in darkness. But as we reflected on Good Friday, in the darkness, Jesus was taking the darkness in on of himself, and he was carrying the burden of sin and death. And upon the cross, it seems like the dark wins for a moment, but Jesus is actually defeating it. And so what we remember this morning, and I think it's aptly illustrated by what our weather patterns will be today, is that light just begins to break. As this cloud cover begins to burn off, the sun will come through. And this is like Jesus' resurrection, where what has happened is slowly breaking through and it's dawning on people. That term dawning is when something is a realization as light begins to break through. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. And what we're celebrating today is the reality of the resurrection broke into the human world with the coming of the first light. And this is reminiscent of the first light that brought the world into being in Genesis 1. This was a second creation. This was the completion of what was prophesied in the book of Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, it says, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in a land of deep darkness, a light has dawned." This light was evidence in Jesus as he walked around. People saw something different in him. People also reacted to him because light is an antiseptic. In a sense, light casts on the darkness, illuminating where things wrong are happening. Injustice and corruption does not like light. That's why Leslie Newbegin said, "The light has come into the world, and that this coming of the light also and necessarily brings judgment because men love darkness rather than light." And so what we see is that Jesus is light. In John 1, 4 verses 5, I've got a whole bunch of verses, I think, here, talking about Jesus as the light. It says, in him was life, and his life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. That's what we read to begin with. John 8, 12, when Jesus again spoke to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Matthew 17, verse 2, and Jesus, as he goes to the top of the mountain, he is transfigured. What does this mean? It means his physical form changes where he becomes radiant light, so that no one believes in me should stay in the darkness. I've come into the world as light, so that no one who believes in me shall... I've gone ahead there. I'm just getting excited. Let me go back to the transfiguration. There he was, transfigured before him. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. John 12, 46, I have come into the world as light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 6 says, for God said, let light shine out of the darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. What these verses do is they emphasize Jesus' role as the light of the world, bringing illumination, truth, and salvation to humanity. They link two vital concepts. Number one, that throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, God was described as light. Light symbolizes God's presence, his purity, and his glory. And the prophets also prophesied that the Messiah would come as light. As we've read, some of the Isaiah prophecies speak of Jesus as the great shining light of salvation. These two concepts come together, the Messiah and God in Jesus. Jesus is the light. Now, we focused on the parallels on Good Friday between the darkness that falls as Jesus is crucified at midday for 3 hours and the darkness that falls as the penultimate plague in the story of the Exodus. In Exodus 10, verses 21 to 22, it said this, then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sky so the darkness spreads over Egypt, darkness that can be felt. This is not just an eclipse. This is a darkness that can be felt. It's captive, it's immersive, it's oppressive. So Moses stretched his hand towards the sky and total darkness covered all of Egypt for 3 days. It continues on in verse 23. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. This is pointing to a kind of arrangement in the world where certain places of dwelling will be covered in darkness, but other places will be places of light. The people of God had light in a culture of darkness. Now, we remember the story that after Jesus is resurrected, of the two disciples who were walking the Emmaus Road, they come across the resurrected Jesus, not recognizing him. He comes into the house, and as they break bread and as he expounds the scriptures, they say of each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? They burned because Jesus, the glory of God, resides in the hearts of believers. When we just heard Dara's story, there was a kind of light burning. Could you see it? Someone who is profoundly changed from the inside out. When you see someone who is aflame for Jesus, it is evident. And we see this all through the New Testament, the shift that happens at this moment as the curtain is torn from the top to the bottom is the light no longer just resides in a menorah in the temple. The Shekinah glory is not just kept behind a curtain in the holiest of holies, that Jesus' presence comes out into the world. Jesus' price on the cross that he paid means that he can come and meet to us face to face. And so the light is not something which we cannot enter. During the nativity of Jesus, a light accompanies the angels To the shepherds, a star, a light in the sky, guides the Magi to the house where Jesus is born. During Paul's conversion, a heavenly light surrounds him. When an angel frees Peter from prison, a light illuminates the cell. Believers are called out of darkness into God's marvelous light. This is why in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, it says, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." Did you get that? You are called out of darkness into light. Dara told us the story there of parts of her life, hurts, parts of her past, which she felt was so deep in the dark, they could never be brought into the light of God. But in that light is healing. In that light is wholeness. As Dara said, she is not the finished product. None of us are. But this is an invitation that comes to us on Resurrection Sunday, that do we believe that the resurrection power that brought Jesus from the grave is actually available for us to renew us, to reshape us, to reform us? And the direction of the history of the world from here on in, whatever happens in the world, whatever twists and turns the history books will have for us, it's the story of ordinary people, like the story that Dara just said, the story of Mary who goes to the tomb and meets Jesus thinking he's a gardener until he calls out her name, Mary, and she recognized the risen Lord. The disciples on the Emmaus Road, the stories we see in Scripture, ordinary people whose lives are profoundly transformed. You know what? This morning I got in a little tiz. Maybe it was the chocolate. I was preparing and going over my talk, and I looked at the paper, and I've looked at the paper almost all my life. And it's one of the habits. I read the paper, and today you can read papers from all over the world now digitally. And it's just fascinating, the story that gets told. And there's different subtleties and nuances. I'm not going to go into them all this morning. We don't have time. But the overwhelming story that you often see in the Australian coverage of Easter is one of decline. Less people going to church. When good news stories are told of churches that are contemporary and growing, there always must be a sort of hue put over them, a question mark. And so I was reading this, and you read it, and sometimes you can almost imbibe the negativity. But I thought about it. And I thought, what's actually happened is that there was a period in our culture where lots of people went to church because that's what you did. The cultural pressure was to go to church. That stopped as the cultural pressure to do lots of community events has withered away. And you don't realize me this morning? Also, the cultural pressure to read the newspaper has withered away. The church has gone from around 45% of people who attended a church service once a month in Australia to around, I think it's like 15, 17% who go once a month. Not surprising when the cultural pressure is reduced. The good news story of that is increasingly the people in church are actually the ones who have the light in them, and are actually here not because of a cultural pressure, but are actually here because Jesus is doing something in them, and this stuff is real for them, not just a cultural script. But at the same time, there's another terminal decline that is occurring that is far more dramatic and will probably end in our lifetime. Newspapers, forgive my rudeness, are stuffed. Less and less people read them. Less and less people. Once the baby, I love baby boomers in the room. You're the main newspaper readers. You're keeping the newspapers going. Some people look at them every 6 weeks online. Once you retire into glory, praise God, we will bury the newspaper probably in the ground. I like newspapers. I read them. They're great. But The church is going to outlive the newspaper. I mentioned the Argus. The Argus is dead. The Age, the Herald Sun, whatever, they'll all die. This is not a slate against the media. I think we need a healthy, good media. But we need to remember that what this story tells us is the story that God is writing in history, is that history ends with us in the presence of God, in the light, that the new Jerusalem comes from the heaven, that we will dwell with the Father. And God is inviting you to be reshaped as Christ. That's the invitation. That's the direction of history. Whatever changes may happen in the world, whatever geopolitical shifts, economic shifts, cultural shifts, you have an invitation to be called out of darkness into his wonderful light. That's the big picture. The micro picture is that some of you come today with parts of darkness in your heart. Some of you come with hurts that you just think are too deep. Some of you come with things that you feel could never be forgiven. Some of you come and maybe even just think, man, am I one of those cultural Christians that Mark's talking about there? The good news, as Dara said, what differentiates her from you is a nothing. The invitation is there for everyone. Jesus took your sin upon a cross. Jesus beat death. Jesus rose on the third day. And the invitation to have your heart burned as the disciples on the Emmaus Road did is before us today. He is risen. That was rubbish. He is risen. So what we're going to do as a countercultural signifier of joy and hope is you went and just said hello and you talked about eggs. We're just going to have a few moments now, and I'll bring it back in a second where we'll pray. Up out of your seats, greet each other with the classic ancient greeting that I just led you through. Go around, tell 10 people, he is risen indeed. You can do 20, go for it.